This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 69 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as he always is Mike Morrison. Today, we'll be discussing the philosophical themes and issues in the Deep Space Nine episode, Rapture. Mike, I'm pleased to see you found the lost podcast studio of Bahala.
It wasn't easy. I had a couple of late nights, but then it was just like a lightning bolt struck me, Zachary, and here I am.
Is it me, Mike, or is the windscreen on your podcast microphone a little brighter than usual?
Seems like everything's a little brighter than usual. I figure I would just sit back and enjoy the show.
Well, Mike, when I first suggested talking about this issue on Metatrex, I think we were both excited about this episode. This has always been one of my favorite episodes of Deep Space Nine in general. How about you?
It is. And I have to say that during its original airing, this episode, I read that they were concerned about the reception of the episode. The episodes of Deep Space Nine that were really rich in Bajoran mythology, Bajoran religion, where Sisko's wrestling with his role as the emissary, didn't always view well, and they often got mixed reviews. This, however, was received very well and is a very popular episode among fans. So, like many fans, I think this is a fantastic episode. It's got a lot going on. On the surface, you can say, well, it's that whole science and religion thing, and you can wave a hand and forget about it. And what you would miss is a lot of really good ethical discussions that take place, especially as it relates to medical ethics. There are some really interesting themes woven in here about personal responsibility, politics. There's a lot going on in this episode, and I think that you're really doing it a disservice to just dismiss it as, oh, it's one of those emissary episodes, or oh, it's one of those, you know, Star Trek doubling in religion episodes, and forget about it. You'd really be missing out.
Yeah, I guess I don't understand that criticism, because I think that science and religion is not one of the strongest elements in this episode, although it's part of the episode, but I don't think that's one of the major themes of the episode. And I myself think of this episode as one of the strongest character episodes for Captain Sisko. This is where he really comes to terms with his role as the emissary. And yeah, I guess I was a little too young to even realize that there would be people who wouldn't like this aspect of Deep Space Nine when it first aired. You know, does that criticism still persists, do you think? Do people still not like the dabbling into Bajoran mythology and religion, or is that something that was a problem in the 90s but people have come to terms with since?
That's a great question, and I have to say that I've seen discussions on Star Trek boards where fans are still uneasy about Deep Space Nine as a whole in the Star Trek universe because it is so laden with Bajoran religion and mythology. There are a lot of fans who just don't appreciate Deep Space Nine for those reasons. And I understand, but on the same hand, I have to say that to wave a hand to dismiss it for that reason, I just think that you're missing out on really one of the best written iterations of Star Trek. The writing throughout Deep Space Nine is incredible. And when we get here to the fifth season, which Rapture is fifth season, about midway through, some of the writing is just, it's just doggone brilliant. I mean, there's just no other way to describe it. And you're right. You're absolutely right. This was an episode where Sisko's character is really built upon. I think that this particular episode was defining for his character, and it really informed who he becomes as we move into the sixth and seventh season. It really shaped the person of Benjamin Sisko. And I think Avery Brooks did a brilliant job. I think we got to see a little bit more of Avery Brooks and a little bit less of Captain Sisko, but it's a great episode.
Well, Mike, don't forget, as Ardra from Next Generation would say, we live in a universe filled with magic.
Indeed we do. And that's one of the interesting things about this episode, Zachary, and I know we'll get into it as we're discussing, but there's something really interesting happens early on in the episode. Captain Sisko is electrocuted. I don't know any other way to describe it. He's working on a program in the holosuite. He saves the program, and he is electrically charged. There's some kind of discharge from the panel that he's working on, and he ends up in the floor. Quark calls for medical emergency. And the next thing we know, we find out that his brain has been hyperstimulated, and it's because of this physiological reaction to what's happened to him that allows him to understand the mysteries of the universe and decipher this code that allows him to find the lost city of Bahala. And I think that's really interesting because there's a lot of science packed into that, a lot of provable science that we have extensive research regarding, and that is that a very small portion of our brains are active and working. And if there were a way to stimulate other parts of our brains, the potential is incredible as to what they believe we would be able to understand and accomplish.
To me, this is one of the most interesting parts of the episode. It's multifaceted. There's the part you mentioned, this relationship between what's going on in the brain and how it manifests itself in our consciousness or our rational abilities. And in this case, it gets a little weird because Sisko's hyperstimulated brain results in some sort of extrasensory perception. He's able to gain insights into what's going on in other people's lives as he's walking around, almost like the Pope walking around blessing people at the end of at the end of the episode.
Go home.
You don't belong here. And it, don't worry, things will be okay with your son, and this, that, and the other thing. It's great stuff. But another aspect of that's related to this that really fascinated me is this notion that Captain Sisko is not seeing any different evidence that other people don't see. He's got all the stuff about Bahala. He's got the stuff going on with Bajor and their entry into the Federation. So he's got the same kind of raw materials, but he's managing to see those raw materials in a different way. Like he's having some sort of mental gestalt shift where he's able to synthesize all this information, and it results in some sort of mental clarity of understanding, like a moment of insight. It's really almost a flash of insight. And he's so worried about losing his flash of insight in the episode, but it sounds a lot to me like the kind of gestalt shift you get. Are you familiar with like the duck rabbit example?
Vaguely, yes.
Yeah, it's a drawing where it looks like, yes. On the one hand it looks like a duck's head, and on the other hand it looks like a rabbit's head. And it's the same drawing. It just depends how you look at it, right? And your mind can kind of shift back and forth between these two understandings of the same picture. And I think something like that is what's going on with Captain Sisko. He is looking at all the same raw materials, but he's looking at it in a new, insightful way. And he's so worried about losing that insight.
I've seen that example. I'm not one of those people that stop and stare at images on a computer screen for an hour to decipher them. But I've seen a couple of examples of that. There's one that's an old woman, but if you look at it a certain way, it's a young woman holding a baby. And so I think that's a great example because
actually, if you look at Deep Space Nine just the right way, it actually looks like a baseball. That's Captain Sisko's gestalt shift.
Yeah. But that's a great example because in this episode, we kind of get to see Benjamin Sisko in the same light. We see him as a Starfleet captain, but really, for the first time, we get to see kind of that veil pulled away, and we see him fully become the emissary. I mean, it's not Benjamin Sisko being uncomfortable with being in the emissary. It's not a glimpse of the emissary. He really is transformed in this episode, and he really becomes this Bajoran religious figure, this religious icon, the emissary of the prophets.
And I think that's the deeper level of interest for me, that this is, to me, this is the episode that really defines Captain Sisko identifying himself as the emissary rather than, I mean, up until this point, yes, he is the emissary. I think he recognizes he's the emissary, but it's kind of a reluctance embracing of being the emissary. He probably shares the Admiral's concerns about being the emissary. But after this episode, he really becomes, he identifies as the emissary, and that's part of his identity. And I find that a fascinating shift. But that deeper shift and personal identity, I think of as an extension of this gestalt shift that he begins the episode with, right? It's at the beginning, it's just a little gestalt shift, like, oh, I've got this picture, and if I look at it in the right way, I can see these missing characters, and I can put it all together, and I can find the lost city of Bahala. And by the end of the episode, he's making almost a personal gestalt shift, where he's seeing his own life reframed in a new way, embracing his role as the emissary.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting juxtaposition. At the beginning of the episode, it's Benjamin Sisko sitting on the floor of Quark's Hollow Suite with a pad, struggling to make sense of this image, this puzzle he's working on. He's got a hollow image of an ancient tower. It's a picture that they found, and he's working on it. He's trying to decipher the puzzle. He's struggling. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. He's tired, and Quark comes in to kick him out of the Hollow Suite. But then there's this incredible shift, and so then finding the lost city of Bahala is no problem. He does it very easily, but he begins to really kind of lose touch with Captain Sisko. He's not making a whole lot of sense to Admiral Whatley, and you know, his son is having a difficult time understanding him. Cassidy Yates, who, this is Cassidy's homecoming episode. She's been away in a Federation prison for 6 months. That's another interesting little thread that they kind of threw into this. The attitudes towards her after having served her 6 months in a Federation prison. But we'll get to that. But there's this shift. And then at the end of the episode, you know, Sisko's got the Bahala blues when he wakes up from surgery. He's
the Bahala blues.
he's crying. I almost had it. I almost had it. So there's this incredible character shift in this episode, and I have to take my hat off to Avery Brooks for pulling this off, because this could not have been an easy episode, because Sisko is all over the map, you know, throughout this episode. He goes from very Benjamin Sisko to the emissary of the prophets, and there's just this complete shift in his character, and then we kind of shift back. We see a little bit of a merger of the two, but it's really very much Benjamin Sisko at the end of the episode.
Well, the Admiral himself has a bit of a gestalt shift. Sometimes he sees Deep Space Nine as a space station, and sometimes he sees it as a floating bicycle wheel. But seriously, the Admiral is an interesting kind of third-person point of view into what's going on in Captain Sisko. And the Admiral basically tells Sisko, look, you can't have it both ways. You know, are you going to be a Starfleet captain here on Deep Space Nine, or are you going to be the emissary? He's like, I need you to be the Starfleet captain version of you and make get the job done and bring the Bajorans into the Federation. And this is an ongoing tension from this point on in Deep Space Nine, is that he has to walk both. I mean, well, in all of Deep Space Nine, it's an issue, right? He is the emissary, and he also is commander of Deep Space Nine. But after this episode, I think he feels the internal struggle of being both.
Yeah, and you know, I find it fascinating that when we begin the series Deep Space Nine, Benjamin Sisko is tasked by Captain Picard to use any means necessary short of violating the Prime Directive to get Bajor into the Federation. And in this episode, his mission as captain of Deep Space Nine, this mission that he was given, it's been completed. And Whatley says to him, you know, there's going to be a whole lot of details. I love Whatley's character, and I'm a little sad that they didn't bring him back. He was the whole bicycle wheel thing. I would have been offended if I were Sisko and he said that to me, but I think his character's interesting. I wish we could have seen more of him. You know, he's telling him there's a whole lot of details to be overseen, and he's getting ready to transition into the next phase of his captaincy here at Deep Space Nine. But all of that changes when he barges into the room and he, you know, yells, you know, no, it's too soon. We can't do this. And you know, the locusts, he said, they'll destroy Bajor unless it stands alone. And Whatley says, what the hell are you talking about? He said, it's too soon. Bajor must not join the Federation. If it does, it'll be destroyed. And that seemingly would be the end of his captaincy, because, you know, Whatley's just like, okay, he's completely lost his mind. He's violated his orders. But, you know, he manages to sweet talk his way into sticking around. And I don't know if there were ever any long-term repercussions for those actions, but it's fascinating to me that that was his primary mission. And, you know, in this episode, it's about to come to fruition and the emissary puts a stop to it.
And as the Admiral rightly points out, the Bajorans would have his hide if they withdrew him as captain of Deep Space Nine.
And again, as I said at the beginning of the episode today, there are some interesting political things going on in this episode as well. There's just there's a lot of really great stuff happening. They packed a lot into this episode, and I think that's why, of probably all of the emissary episodes in Deep Space Nine, it was this episode that was so well received.
I think even given all of that, I still find kind of Captain Sisko's newfound mental abilities as the most interesting part of the episode for me. I don't know if you've experienced moments like this. You probably have. I think most people probably have if they really take the time to think about it. Having something like a moment of clarity where, you know, the world around you all of a sudden makes sense and you feel like you belong in it, or at least you're aware of it in a way that you haven't been before. Like, I remember one time I was driving around and all of a sudden I was just struck by the mere fact that I was conscious. I mean, it's really strange when you think about it. We live in a world with atoms and molecules and a bunch of inanimate objects like roads and cell phones and just all this stuff laying around. And all of a sudden, boom, here we are in the middle of this ostensibly just physical world as a presence of consciousness in the middle of all of it. And it's really interesting. And to me, that just struck me once, like, wow, that's a flash of insight. Like, whoa, I'm conscious. That's amazing. And it was something like this little moment of insight. And then, boom, it's gone. And you're just back into normal life. And you lose your insight and it just feels like it did 10 minutes before. And it could be about, you know, some sort of religious insight, spiritual insight, revelation, whatever. But I think all of us have probably had some sort of profound moment of clarity about something. And then it's the kind of thing where I think once you have that insight, it's either you hold on to it and all of a sudden everything really does make sense, or you blink and you miss it and the moment's gone and you're back into your normal life. And I think Sisko is having one of those moments where he's on the verge of having this insight. He had enough insight to find Bahala, but he's on this verge of having a deeper, profound understanding of purpose as it relates to the Bajorans and the Prophets and Deep Space Nine. And it's all about to make sense. And then boom, they fix his brain and he loses the insight and he's back into his normal life. And he just didn't quite get to the point where that moment of insight persists.
Yeah. And he says as much. He says, I almost had it. I almost understood it all. And yeah, I can concur. I've had those moments of clarity. And for that matter, it goes beyond that. I have had moments where I have written and I have said things that were profound and beyond really my own it's as though I
well, you better start doing that on Metatrack, Mike. Gotta up your game.
Yeah, I've said something that I stepped away from and went, you know, wow, you know, that was really a profound thing. It was as though I said it before I even realized what I was saying, and it was so profound that it surprised me. And yeah, I mean, I've had those moments where I've you know, I've recognized the gift of consciousness and had deeper understanding of the world around me. So yeah, I mean, I've had those moments. They're unfortunately they're few and far between. But again, I think that points to something really interesting that they're discovering as they gain deeper insights into human physiology and what's going on in the body. And it's interesting because I have read articles where by increasing the flow of oxygen to the brain, it increases perception and increases the brain's ability to process the world around it. And
yeah, coffee works just as well for that, by the way.
Coffee works almost as well. Yeah, electrostimulation.
It's a big leap from coffee to electrostimulation.
Yeah,
exactly. It's one of those mornings, huh?
Yeah, it's what LSD.
You know, there's something about this episode, Mike, that reminds me of like 1960s Timothy Leary kind of research into altered states of consciousness. You know, just the ways in which different effects on the brain can produce different, you know, well, altered states of consciousness. That's really what's going on here. Sisko has an altered state of consciousness as a result of what's happened to his brain. It's like he's taken the electric Rattuccino acid test.
Well, Zachary, I probably shouldn't mention this, but there is a deleted scene where the Federation Men in Black, Section 31, shows up, and they actually were trying to perform the whole thing where Sisko gets shocked. That was like an MK Ultra type project that Section 31 was experimenting with to see if they could expand his mind and control him at the same time. And it failed, and they were actually going to introduce Section 31 into Deep Space Nine at that point, but it hit the cutting room floor, and we got Sloan later on, so...
Do you think that Captain Sisko developed some sort of latent addiction, like he's got to get back to Quark's, like, shock me again, I need my insight.
If so, I'm sure Quark didn't mind, he probably made a few extra strips of latinum off of his newfound obsession.
Yeah, Quark trades on addictions. Absolutely.
I love how in the episode, Quark asks Sisko if he likes puzzles, and he says I've got a whole bunch of pleasure puzzles where there's a surprise in the middle of every one.
Pleasure mazes. Or?
Quark is like the Hugh Hefner of. Deep Space Nine, you know, Larry Flint of Deep Space Nine.
I think an interesting feature of Captain Sisko's vision, and maybe by extension any altered state of consciousness, is the ineffable quality of the experience, right? There's a sense in which you can't explain the experience to someone else, right? Captain Sisko can't explain his moment of clarity very well. Other people don't understand it. They're trying to reduce, like the doctor is just explaining it all away as this, you know, hyperstimulation of the brain, pure reductionism, taking this interesting, novel, phenomenal experience that Captain Sisko is having and just reducing it to synaptic activity. But Captain Sisko can't explain the full flower, the full meaningfulness of his vision to anyone else, just like a drug addict can't explain their LSD trip to someone else, right? Like, oh, there were these colors, man. And like other people just don't get it, right? Because they didn't experience it. And I think these sort of private, interesting, hyper-awareness visions have this ineffable quality. You just fundamentally can't explain them in language to someone else.
I was really waiting for Sisko to turn to Admiral Whatley when he was down in the caverns during the excavation of Bahala. And Whatley's a little irritated with him because he wasn't there to greet him when he showed up at Deep Space Nine. I was really waiting for Sisko to turn around and say to him, Whatley, turn on, tune in, drop out, man.
I can picture, he's kind of like a drug dealer. Hey, buddy, come to Quark's. Get shocked. It'll be great.
Hey, think of yourself and question authority. I think that's a great connection with...
Turn on, tune in, and beam down?
I think that's a great connection, though. You mentioned Timothy Leary. I mean, he developed this whole philosophy of mind expansion and personal truth, but he did it by introducing the idea of using LSD for clinical purposes. And I think we look back and we say that, you know, the whole thing to a great degree was a failure, but he really did add a great deal to the understanding of the mind. And I think without a Timothy Leary, I don't think that we would have some of the deeper understandings of the human brain.
I don't know if you can really call it a failure. Mike, you've worked in the medical industry. Sure. You know the profound success of pharmaceuticals and in treating any number of medical conditions and by extension, psychological conditions. How can you call that program a failure given the massive success in treating any number of different kinds of conditions with what are frankly drugs?
Yeah. And while I agree with that, with that sentiment, I'm just saying, basically, I think for the most part, we as a society look back and we see it primarily as a failure. But I'm not surprised that you would bring him up because, as memory serves, Timothy Leary often referred to himself as a performing philosopher. So,
well, I guess the thing is, the fact that that program has been so successful, like psychological drugs, mm-hmm. I think that fact that that program has been so successful speaks to our human failure more than anything else. In my perfect world, we wouldn't need those things to heal our own sure. psychological weaknesses and reach our full potential. And that speaks more to our failings as a species. I wish we were to a point as a species where we could just sort of through pure sort of psychological and philosophical self-reflection, reach those moments of insight ourselves, cure our ills, and be the best version of ourselves. Now, sadly, we just don't seem to be able to do that in a great many cases without some external stimuli. But I think that, to me, that is more of a failing than a praise for the program of psychological and medical drugs as a treatment for things.
Again, another interesting thread in this episode is the fact that what is going on physiologically for Benjamin Sisko, it's killing him. It's too much for his human body to manage. And it's causing this breakdown of his synapses. And, you know, he's blacking out, he's having seizures, and it's killing him.
Yeah, actually, be careful how much Metatrex you listen to, listeners, because too much Metatrex will hyperstimulate your synapses and you'll be in danger of psychological breakdown. One episode at a time, folks.
Yeah, that's exactly. I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. And you know, that's why typically our typical show length is about an hour and a half. You know, an hour's not quite enough. 2 hours is a little too much. So we hit it in that sweet spot of about an hour and a half, and that's plenty. That's your weekly fix, folks.
We are your daily dose of Bahala right here.
but seriously though, towards the end of the episode, they have to make a decision, and that decision is whether or not they are going to intervene with medicine. And Sisko is opposed to it. He is placing a great deal of value on this expanded insight that he has. He seems to really be embracing his ability to see the world in a whole new light. And obviously, Admiral Whatley is opposed. Julian is really a neutral character. And then you have Major Kira. She's kind of, you know, on the fence, but really wants to see him fulfill his role as the emissary. And then you have Jake, for very personal reasons, doesn't want to lose his father. And Kira really argues for him that, you know, he's an 18-year-old boy, he needs his father. And at the end of the episode, the decision falls to Jake, and he decides to go ahead and operate. And I think that's an interesting thread in this episode, Zachary, that I think deserves a few moments to discuss, and that is medical ethics and personal choice and those things. I think that's really strong and powerful within the episode.
I think the real lesson to be taken away there is that when you take over, when you get a new command, when you get a new post as commander of a space station, make sure you take 5 minutes and fill out your little pad with your living will. And you need to be really granular. In case of finding Bahala, don't use any extreme medical treatments to decrease my synaptic activity.
Well, Zachary, but in the future, I think living wills become so passe. I mean,
well, I mean, the dilemma emerges because in a great many of these medical ethics cases where we have to where it has to be decided what should be done to a patient, it's largely often done because the patient hasn't been clear about his or her own wishes and mm-hmm. can't communicate those wishes when they're unconscious, right? So that's why we have living wills. So beforehand, before there's an emergency, before there's a crisis, you take the time to write out, in this circumstance, do this, in this circumstance, do that. And then that way, when that situation arises, it takes the burden off the doctors, takes the burden off your loved ones to decide what to do. And clearly, Captain Sisko hasn't spelled out what to do in case of finding Bahala. I say that jokingly, but really, you know, that's, you know, Captain Sisko has put everyone else in a very uncomfortable situation of deciding how to treat him, you know, guessing what his wishes are, you know, trying to weigh the value of Sisko's life against their own emotional needs. And they're all trying to decide what to do is best. And they have to make the decision for Captain Sisko because he's unconscious.
Well, that I think that's what I find interesting about this. To some degree, I think Captain Sisko has made his wishes known, and his wish is that they don't intervene, that he's allowed to remain in this condition. But the question I think arises, is he mentally competent to make that decision? Has his state of consciousness been altered in such a way that he is unfit to make that decision for himself? I think that really kind of becomes the debate in the operating room at that point. And at the end of the day, Bashir turns to Jake and says, you know, as his, you know, closest living relative, Jake, you know, he's unable to tell me what to do right now, so it falls to you. And Jake kind of leans to the side of his own needs and his own emotions, and he makes that decision. And I wouldn't call it an apology, but, you know, to some degree, he kind of leans down, he apologizes, and he says, you know, Dad, I need you, and you know, so they perform the surgery, and Sisko wakes up. He's unhappy. I kind of joked earlier about, you know, this kind of over dramatized, I almost had it. But I think that speaks to the sorrow that Sisko feels, having lost this ability to perceive the universe in a way that he was. But it seems that he understands, you know, the position Jake was put in, and certainly understands the decision he's made.
You're making an important point. Even though Captain Sisko is unconscious when the decision is made, he had pretty successfully communicated his intentions mm-hmm. to continue having his visions, right? Everyone knew that when he becomes unconscious in the episode. And speaking of wills, I mean, generally wills are only valid if the person making the will is of sound mind and judgment when the will right. was made. And if that is proven not to be the case, you can overturn a will. And you could plausibly say that, you know, we're not talking about a written living will, but insofar as Captain Sisko has communicated, I want to continue having these visions, that's something like a verbal living will. Mm-hmm. He's communicated his intentions. If it can be shown or accepted that he's not of sound mind and judgment because he's under the influence of these visions or the hyperstimulation of his brain, if that throws his judgment into question, then he's not in a position to dictate his own what's in his own best interest at that point. So it should fall to someone else.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't think you could have a whole legal drama going on in this episode. So I think they compacted.
How boring would that be? Like, oh, let's take it to court.
That's when Barnaby Jones shows
up. We'll call the Enterprise back. We'll have Captain Picard be an advocate. Well, yeah, we do have a few of these courtroom dramas in Star Trek. We get one of them in Deep Space Nine when Worf is accused of blowing up that, you know, firing prematurely on that ship carrying a bunch of civilians. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
We do have these courtroom dramas, and those are good episodes. They're good, just talky episodes, right? But that wouldn't have fit well with this episode.
No. So, you know, they have to compact the whole, you know, the whole legal drama into that medical base scene. And I think it's an interesting thread, and it just speaks to the fact that there's so much more packed into this than this tension between Starfleet science and Bajor's religion.
Now that we're having this discussion about medical ethics, it actually reminds me of the episode Someone to Watch Over Me from Voyager. You know that scene when the ambassador has had too much to drink and he's inebriated and, you know, he's in sickbay and the doctors, you know, they have to decide whether to treat him with the Borg nanoprobes or not, whether that would violate his wishes and his species culture and whatnot. And the doctor just says to Neelix, "You're his caretaker, decide." he goes, "Nanoprobes." That's kind of what's going on in this episode. It's like someone else has to make the decision. Who is it? Okay, Jake, it falls to you. Quick, decide. You know, what do we do?
Jake was slightly more thoughtful than Neelix, though.
I can picture Jake going, "Nanoprobes."
That would have.
They're a little far from Borg space over in Deep Space Nine. No nanoprobes were around.
That would have been awesome. But again, I think that whole medical ethics piece, that this little nugget that you get in the episode, it's great. And again, I think they could have made a whole. It's funny, there are little pieces of this episode I think they could have fleshed an entire episode out around, and I mean a good episode out around. You know, you do have that tension between science and religion. You do have this little medical ethics thing. There's this really interesting political drama going on. Just there's so much packed in this. It's phenomenal. Speaking of the tension between faith, I have to say, before I completely forget about this, Worf actually has one of my favorite lines in all of Star Trek. This is one of my favorite lines, and Worf has it in this episode. There's this really fascinating debate going on among the senior crew and ops, and they're all recognizing that Sisko's not in good shape. You know, physically, he is deteriorating. And Kira says, "Listen, I know you guys are worried," she says, "but the prophets are leading the emissary on this path for a reason." And Worf jumps in. He says, "Do not attempt to convince the Major. They cannot understand." And Dax says, "Since when did you believe in the prophets?" And Worf says, here's the line, quote, "What I believe in is faith. Without it, there can be no victory. If the captain's faith is strong, he will prevail," end quote. And Jadzia responds by saying, "That's not much to bet his life on." Kira says, "You're wrong. It's everything." What a great discussion there.
There's something weird about that quote, though, because Worf seems to be implying that it doesn't actually matter whether the thing you have faith in is true or not, right? That's not he doesn't really expect the prophets as some sort of mystical beings to save Sisko. That's not what he's saying. He's saying that Sisko has the ability to heal himself with the aid of his mental powers as a result of faith, that faith plays some sort of role from the first person standpoint. And that's more important than whether or not those external beliefs, the things you have faith in, are true or not. And to me, that bothers me a bit, because when you have faith in something, you expect that the thing you have faith in to be true. That's what you believe in, right? So I think he might be doing the notion of faith a little bit of a disservice in this episode, because people who have faith don't just have faith in their own faith. They have faith in the things they believe in that they think are true.
Well, again, what I find fascinating about that, and I'm not saying this to say that I advocate having faith in anything. You know, obviously, being a Christian, I have faith in God, and I believe that I've placed my faith in the one true living God. But that being said, I know that there is a lot of science out there that supports that notion that Worf has, and that is that people who exercise faith and participate in religion. And it seems that in many of these studies, there's no preference given to, you know, their religion. It's simply that they are people who are of faith. And what we are finding is that people who have faith in something, who practice a religion, who place their faith in something, they overall are happier people. They have more fulfilling relationships. They recover from illness quicker. We've done studies on hospital stays and recovery after surgery, and we found that people who are of faith, and again, no preference given to what faith that is, tend to have better overall patient outcomes coming out of a critical situation in those instances.
Well, I think this is where it's really important to keep separate things separate, because it's really easy to conflate these two issues, right?
Sure it is.
One issue is whether or not the beliefs are actually true, whether you know, if you have faith in a divine being, whether that divine being actually exists in some sort of metaphysical reality, right? That's one issue, the truth of the belief. The other issue is the issue you're raising, which is the issue of therapeutic properties, right? Having faith in something might actually be self-healing or lead to a good community or lead to a healthy mental state, any number of benefits of having faith in something in general. But the therapeutic properties of having faith in something in the medical or psychological sense that you mentioned is not evidence for the truth of the beliefs themselves.
You know, it occurs to me, Zachary, and I'm having flashbacks. I'm having moments of clarity going back to my days in middle school. I'm a little bit older than you, as we've mentioned many times here on the podcast.
And wiser.
I can go back to the late 70s, early 1980s, in my days in elementary and middle school, junior high for those folks that don't know what a middle school is. But I recall that our counselors in our school were pushing this concept of POPs, the power of positive thinking.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that, because my grandfather on my mother's side, my maternal grandfather, Roger Forcell, he was a World War II bomber pilot, mm-hmm. and he became a school principal. And he was known for he was an advocate of the power of positive thinking. You know?
Yes.
Thinking well about your own situation, being nice to other people, but just changing the world through positive thinking. And people around my town remember him because of that. And mm-hmm. I think it just resonated with me. Like, wow, yeah, power of positive thinking. We need to remind ourselves of that.
Yeah. And we have to thank Norman Vincent Peale, who was an American minister and author, you know, for that concept. But, you know, in the late 1970s, early 1980s, that was the thing. And we were, for lack of a better way of putting it, we were kind of indoctrinating our school children, at least in my region. This was a huge thing with this, you know, this concept of positive thinking. I remember back in the days when you still did Pledge of Allegiance and you had announcements every day, the principal would get on the loudspeaker. Every morning we would have our Pledge of Allegiance, and then there would be some announcements. And he always finished the announcements of the day by saying, "Act positive, think positive, and be a positive person, and have a super day."
It sounds like the end of a Mr. Rogers Neighborhood episode, honestly. But that comes from the same kind of thinking, I think.
Yes.
It's not a criticism. I think those are just, you know, intimately related concepts.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think perhaps that is to some degree what we're seeing here with Worf's comment. You know, Worf's a spiritual person. He doesn't believe in the prophets, but he is a spiritual person. And I like how he, being a Klingon warrior, equates this faith, this positive thinking aspect with victory. He says, without faith, there can be no victory. So, you know, that's a very Klingon way of looking at it. But I think there is something to be said for positive thinking. I read a book a while back where, you know, there was a whole chapter dedicated to this concept of living as if.
Welcome to Mr. Roshenko's Neighborhood. Do not underestimate the power of positive thinking.
Mr. Roshenko's Neighborhood.
Have a nice day.
You see, they are insane.
I can see Worf coming in and putting a sweater vest on.
You are beautiful just
and
the
picking
way
up
you
his
are.
Blood wine. Hello, children.
Yeah, rather than feeding the fish every day, it's, you know, feeding the targs every day.
Yeah, the trolley is now a bird of prey. It's instead of King Friday, we have, you know, Chancellor Gowron, or better yet, we have Emperor Kalus, little Emperor Kalus puppet
with Worf kind of doing the voices for the puppet.
Oh my gosh, I'm dying.
Well, what's funny about this, I think, is that Worf is usually like the most negative person around. He's always seeing the worst side of every situation. For him to go, do not underestimate the power of faith. You know, all of a sudden he's turned into an optimist. do not underestimate the power of positive thinking.
I see. Now I totally have retconned this whole thing in my brain. I have a whole new headcanon with this. I see this scene being acted out with Worf having little puppets. Do not underestimate the power of faith.
Now I'm kind of picturing the beginning of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, you know, where he comes in, he takes his shoes off, changes the shoes, and changes the sweater. I can picture Worf, like, coming into his quarters. It's such a good feeling to know you're alive. And he's unzipping his uniform and putting on his casual clothes, putting on some slippers.
Lets his hair down. He takes his little ponytail out, fluffs his hair.
That is so funny for some reason. Sorry, listeners, that was quite a tangent, but what a funny idea.
Oh, that's great. It's great. Somebody needs to contact Michael Dorn and have him do a Kickstarter campaign. I want to see a Mr. Rogers style children's program with Worf as the Mr. Rishenko's Neighborhood. Every episode ends with the words, "Death to the enemy."
Have a good day. Death to the enemy.
Kapla.
Do you think that's how Klingon children's programming goes? Klingon public television? KPT? Actually, when I was a kid out here in California, the main PBS station was KQED. I can picture that pronounced in Klingon. Welcome to KQED. We have beat this horse to a death, but it is very funny.
Yeah, somehow we went from Norman Vincent Peale to Mr. Rishenko's Neighborhood. I love it. Only right here on Metatrax.
We're joking about all this, but there's a serious point here, which is that people who have faith and people who don't have faith often talk past each other because they can't understand each other's worldview. Mm-hmm. So I think Worf is right in saying, don't bother trying to convince them. They're not going to understand because they don't have faith. I think that's... it's kind of sad that that's true, that people can't find more common ground. But I think in reality, that often is true, that people have such different worldviews that even though they use the same language, they're often just talking past each other. They don't understand each other's basic assumptions and basic worldview. Here we have a theistic and a non-theistic worldview, and the tension between the two and the miscommunication that happens, all happening right in Ops in Deep Space Nine.
And another little aspect, just to kind of move the conversation along a little bit, is a... bit of a thin alliance that is formed between Sisko and Wynn. Wynn seems to embrace Sisko's newfound ability, and she's very supportive. Although Kira, toward the end of the episode, pokes some holes in that idea and kind of accuses her of having her own agenda and so on. I think it's really interesting, the alliance that seems to be formed here within this episode. It becomes its own little crucible as far as the relationship between Sisko and Wynn is concerned, but it's an interesting one nonetheless.
Yeah, but I don't trust Wynn as far as I can throw her, so there's always a hidden motivation with her.
I agree completely, and I think Kira calls her on it, but I find it interesting because there does seem to be, she's being sincere and she's being helpful, and that's a little confusing for me. Sisko, I think he is so driven to kind of get the most he can out of his altered state that I think he's very Sisko in this. He's going to do whatever he needs to do. He's gonna politic her a little bit. He wants to have that orb experience, so he kind of forms a fragile relationship with her within this episode that doesn't seem to go beyond the episode. But I just thought it was fascinating. This was kind of an interesting episode for Wynn as well.
I really enjoy the discussion between Kira and Wynn when Kira basically tells her it takes a lot of courage to admit when you're wrong. And she says, well, it's funny. Her response I find interesting. Her response wasn't, oh, you think I'm wrong. Her response was, you think I don't have courage.
Yeah, and she really kind of becomes sympathetic in that little discourse right there because assuming that she's telling the truth, and we have nothing to base an assumption that she's lying upon, but she says she remembers every single beating that she received, So in some ways, she becomes very sympathetic within this episode, because you see that she is just like every other Bajoran. She suffered under the hand of the Cardassians, and I can't think of another way to put it. She really gains some sympathy points within this episode.
Well, what about her overall concern about Bajor entering the Federation? She's concerned that, well, two things. Maybe that's not a good thing for Bajor in general, but her second point was that there hasn't been enough time to repair the damage done to their culture. They need to stand alone, as Sisko would say, for a longer period of time before they're, quote, ready to join the Federation. So two things. What about Bajor in particular? You know, have they had enough time? Are they really ready to be a participating member of the Federation? And B, should we be worried about this cultural assimilation element about worlds that join the Federation in general? I mean, in joining the Federation, isn't there just this broad brushstroke danger that the culture will be watered down, destroyed, that the cultures on these worlds won't be able to maintain their cultural integrity in a broader political entity like the Federation?
That's a great question, and I can only speculate. You know, first of all, Wynn has always... From literally the moment we've met her, she seemed to have an agenda that included keeping Bajor for the Bajorans. She had an alliance early on with the Circle, and so her agenda has always been Bajor for Bajorans, I think. I think, and it's sad that we didn't kind of revisit that whole Circle thing later on, because you got to know that, you know, they didn't destroy that movement. They may have damaged it, but I don't think that Circle trilogy, I don't think that was the end of the Circle. I think they, in the real world, I think they would have continued to build and grow. And she certainly seemed to hold a sentiment that, you know, was Bajor for the Bajorans.
Well, Wynn basically makes a comparison between the Cardassian occupation and now the just at their doorsteps Federation membership, right? Mm-hmm. Under the Cardassian occupation, they were forbidden from worshiping the prophets, essentially, right? She says as much in the episode, that they were put in prison and whatnot. Where the Federation's not going to tell them they can't have their religion and can't worship the prophets and can't do the things they do that make them culturally Bajoran. And I think that right there is the difference between kind of a healthy political entity in a melting pot kind of society and a more dictatorial power regime that threatens people's liberty, right? That's not what's going on with the Federation. The Federation aren't going to tell them they can't worship who they want to worship, whereas that did happen under the Cardassian occupation.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you asked an interesting question a moment ago, and that is in terms of Bajor being ready to enter the Federation, or should they stand alone on their own? I have an interesting take on that, and I'm sure this will raise some discussion in the Babel Conference under our show thread. But
are you about to ruffle some feathers?
It might ruffle a few feathers. I think that Bajor missed out on a few opportunities. Certainly at the, and we have to look at Deep Space Nine as a whole. Yes, if you look at Deep Space Nine as a whole, you realize once you get to the end of the Dominion War, Sisko was absolutely right. Had Bajor joined the Federation here in Season 5, Episode 10, Bajor would have been destroyed by the Dominion. There's no doubt in my mind he was right. The Dominion would have set their sights on Bajor, and I think it would have meant the end of Bajor.
But don't they have their sights on Bajor anyway? Like, I guess I don't understand why that's the case. Like, what difference does that make in terms of the threat from the Dominion?
Well, I think that the Dominion threat would have been more militaristic against Bajor. There didn't seem to be any type of major offensive against Bajor. Bajor was able to remain neutral to some degree.
Yeah,
because they
weren't
part of the Dominion. I think the Dominion,
they're targeting the Alpha Quadrant and the power center of the Alpha Quadrant, namely Earth and the Federation. Bajor is, in their mind, somewhat inconsequential.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. Just, mm-hmm. You know, in much the same way that the Zindi on their way to Earth, you know, at least in the alternative reality, they were taking out every settlement that they, I mean, they took out the moon, they took out Mars, everything that they could take out on their way to Earth, they took out. And I think it would have been the same way with the Dominion. I think they would have, you know, gone in with a militaristic campaign and just laid waste to Bajor just to just to send a ripple throughout the Alpha Quadrant as to just what's coming. You know, it's a warfare of fear. But to answer your question, you know, it's funny because as I look at Deep Space Nine, I thought Bajor was ready early on to stand with Federation. I think early on they would have benefited by rapidly making themselves ready and becoming part of the Federation. I think they stand to benefit. In fact, I'll go even back further beyond that. In the second season, one of the first cultures to kind of be introduced from the Gamma Quadrant coming into the Alpha Quadrant was the Skrian. And the Skrian wanted to settle on Bajor, thinking that it was their paradise, Quintana. And they really felt that they had something to offer Bajor. They were farmers. And, you know, Bajor had a lot of land that needed the loving care of skilled farmers. And they had suggested a symbiotic sort of relationship where farmers, you know, we can not only take care of ourselves, but, you know, Bajor would benefit from our skills and our abilities. And, you know, that relationship didn't manifest, and it really caused a schism between Bajor and the Skrians. We didn't revisit that later on, but they, you know, Kira and, you know, the Skrian lady, they did not part on good terms. And I look back at that and I have to wonder, was that a good call or not? You know, would Bajor have, I think Bajor had some missed opportunities to really put themselves in a better position than they were in, even by the end of the series. It's a point of opinion, but it's my opinion nonetheless.
You know, it's interesting to think how my own thinking has shifted on some of these issues. Like when I now think of this language that's used in Star Trek, like whether a culture is ready to join the Federation or not ready to join the Federation, what I hear now is kind of a quasi, it's not quite racist, but it's like an almost racist judgment about a culture. Like that they're just haven't developed enough to be like us enough. So they're not ready to join our mm-hmm. club yet. You know, there's this implicit judgment going on. And when you were talking now about, you know, the fact that there can be this symbiotic relationship, like, oh, we're good farmers and we have a lot of land, you know, here in California, and this should resonate with you too down there in Texas, you know, here's like, we've got a lot of land in California. We could really benefit from some migrant farm workers coming up from Mexico. and that, but I guess my point is that connotes all the race politics that goes along with those kinds of issues, labor issues and race issues. Mm-hmm. And Star Trek just glosses over all of these issues. You know, they talk about whether culture's ready or not. We can talk about the symbiotic relationship. We can go, you know, this is a great symbiotic relationship for me to own all this land and have all these Mexican workers working it for me. That's a great symbiotic relationship. You go, well, wait a minute, what about the inequality and the power structures and the racism and the community? And what about all this stuff? You're like, oh, no, it's a symbiotic relationship, right? You can just gloss over all of the deeper problematic issues using that language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great point. And again, and that whole discussion has very little to do with this episode, Rapture, but, you know, in answering your question, you know, was Bajor ready or not ready? I just think over the course of the first, you know, five and a half seasons, I think there were a few missed opportunities for Bajor to really kind of step up and benefit from, you know, Federation technology, Federation help, and they were getting help from the Federation, but I think that there was more for them to, it would have been more for their benefit had they have joined the Federation early. But again, looking at Deep Space Nine as a whole, it's just a darn good thing that they weren't, or the Dominion would have laid waste to it.
Well, in the interest of fleshing out the nature of this symbiotic relationship, we can talk about mutual benefits. So certainly Bajor benefits from the protection of the Federation. Certainly the Federation benefits from having easy access to the wormhole. So what else does Bajor bring to the Federation? What does it offer the Federation other than easy access to the wormhole and being on the front lines of the Cardassian front line?
Well, again, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think those really are the benefits. I think Bajor offered a staging point because even though we get to Deep Space Nine, there's a peace that exists between the Federation and Cardassia. It's an uneasy peace. And so I think Bajor offered a strategic place to kind of stage the Federation's containment of Cardassian aggressions. But you know, to kind of even firm my point a little bit with the Dominion and their treatment of Bajor, had they become part of the Federation, I think when we get to the end of Deep Space Nine, what the Dominion did to Cardassia, I think really just makes my point. I mean, they were an ally that turned on the Dominion, and the Dominion, when we get to the end of Deep Space Nine, Cardassia is just laid waste. I mean, I don't think we really think about that a whole lot, but they really laid waste to Cardassia.
I guess I was thinking of a slightly different kind of question rather than sort of political benefits and political and military strategy benefits. I'm thinking more in terms of the sort of racial personality traits that the Bajorans have. Like Vulcans, when they're in the Federation, bring the benefit of logic. Humans bring the benefit of leadership and curiosity. You can kind of go down the list. Each, you know, Klingons bring the benefit of, you know, loyalty and honor and, you know, their military strength. What benefit do the Bajorans bring as kind of their defining traits as a people? I think, you know, their spirituality is part of it because the Federation sure. has this radically atheistic, non-spiritual view, which is not problematic. I mean, you know, different people think different things about that, but certainly the Federation takes that approach and they're tolerant and they respect other cultures
right.
and the Bajorans bringing their deep seated spirituality into the Federation. It's an interesting tension. It would up the tension between, you know, what we already see in Deep Space Nine between science and religion and whatnot. But what benefits do they bring as people to the Federation?
Yeah. I think of all of the species that we're introduced to throughout the Star Trek universe, I think the Bajorans are really balanced in terms of, you know, they're militaristic like the Klingons. And it seems like, especially the women, I mean, you know, we meet Rolaren in TNG. She's a tough gal. And we get Major Kira. She's a tough gal. So especially the Bajoran women seem to be a little more on the aggressive side. But they're very balanced. I mean, they're somewhat militaristic, you know, kind of a guerrilla warfare sort of culture because they had to be. They have the arts. They seem to be a thinking people. But more than any other species within the Star Trek universe, it's the spirituality and the religion. It really is the central focal point of the Bajoran culture. I mean, it is hard to think of Bajor without thinking of, you know, their religion, their spiritual culture. So I think probably more than anything, that's going to be it. And again, I think they benefit from the Federation, but I think the Federation also benefits from them. It brings an interesting balance, I think, that honestly, in my opinion, is needed.
Well, other races in Star Trek can be a little simplistic. I mean, the fact that we can go Vulcans, logic, Klingons, militarism, you can kind of make these one-to-one correlations between mm-hmm. races and personality traits. With the Bajorans, you can't really do that. Yeah, you can go, yeah, spiritual people, but then you go, wait, no, they've got the military thing, they've got strong women, they've got all this stuff that defines them as a people. And that complexity, I think, better captures the reality of life as I know it compared to the other races in Star Trek. I think you can look at Bajorans and go, yeah, all of their different multifaceted character traits are much more like real human life here on Earth.
And I think that is less of a phenomenon within the Star Trek universe and more of just the simple fact that they were such a focus on an entire series, and we had the ability to flesh this culture out probably more so than any other culture.
Yeah, you're right. If we had a Klingon series or a Vulcan series, mm-hmm. we would flesh out all that complexity too, I'm sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the understanding that we have of the Cardassians. I know kind of a sneak peek for our listeners, but I know a few episodes up the road, we've got a Cardassian Virtue Ethics episode on tap. And the only reason that we can really have that kind of discussion is the fact that, you know, we were able to really flesh them out within the realm of Deep Space Nine. You know, we met them, but they were sort of an alien of the week kind of thing in
on Cardassia Prime. On Cardassia Prime, ethics have you.
So, Zachary, any final thoughts on the fifth season episode Rapture from Deep Space Nine?
Well, just to recap, I think this episode is interesting to me on a few levels. It's interesting to me because we see Captain Sisko really embrace his role as the emissary for the first time, I think. I mean, really internalize the role and become the emissary rather than just being called the emissary and tolerating being the emissary. I think the notion of gestalt shifts at the beginning of the episode, seeing things in a new light, you know, having an altered state of consciousness, having a flash of insight that only you understand, that only lasts for a little moment of time, that you can't convey to other people. I've had moments like that. You've had moments like that. I'm sure our listeners have had moments like that. And it's fun to see kind of a first-person window into Captain Sisko's moment of insight that often we just don't get to share with other people. If I have a moment of insight, I can go, Mike, I just had this flash of insight. You're like, okay, great, I didn't. Right. You can't really convey that to other people very well. And here we get to actually live Captain Sisko's moment of insight along with him as much as that's possible. And I think that's fascinating. Again, it's related to some issues in philosophy, like the duck rabbit example and the notion that your mind is active in shaping the reality that you perceive. We get to see Captain Sisko's mind allowing him to perceive reality in a new way. And that's something that we get from 19th century philosophy onward, this notion that your mind can be active in shaping reality, and different philosophers have fleshed that out in different ways. But here I think we get to see one variety of that. So and more importantly, I think this is just one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek. I think this is an episode I go back to in Deep Space Nine again and again. I always get something from it. I, like Sisko, can't resist a puzzle. The notion that they haven't been able to find this lost city of Bahala, that's an irresistible puzzle. And I think we as people are often like that. When there's something we don't understand, some missing piece of information, some mystery, we want to solve the mystery. And that's part of who we are. That's part of our character traits as a species. We find mysteries irresistible. And I like seeing Captain Sisko's inability to resist trying to find the lost city of Bahala, even though people have been trying for thousands of years and have never succeeded. Philosophy is like that, right? We keep beating our heads trying to solve the mysteries of you know, reality and knowledge and ethics. And, you know, these are in philosophy, we don't really get strong answers. We just keep having new questions that come up and we have better or worse answers. We reframe questions in new ways, but darn it, it's still a mystery. And we just keep struggling, trying to find the answers, even though no one's really succeeded. And so you could think of this whole episode as a metaphor for philosophy. Philosophers are always trying to find the lost city of Bahala, some sort of metaphor for knowledge or reality or ethics, whatever the actual answers to philosophical questions.
I'm telling you, man, that is the Bahala blues right there. It's you're trying to find the answers.
Philosophers, you know, have the Bahala blues. All you philosophers out there, I'm sorry, you've got the Bahala blues.
You got the Bahala blues. When you try to find the answer, but the answers just aren't coming, that is the Bahala blues.
And then once in a while, you do get a moment of insight where you learn something genuinely new, and that moves the whole discussion forward.
Yeah, and I couldn't have said it better myself. And I said early in the podcast, and I'm going to say it again, there's just so much packed in this episode. I mean, what's not to love? You have a little bit of political intrigue. You've got, you know, science religion. You've got kind of this medical ethics drama that goes on in it. Personal responsibility. You're kind of in there with Sisko solving a puzzle. Those are always fun, you know, when you solve a puzzle. And I have to say too, that even though it was in a somewhat superficial manner, I'm glad that this wasn't the last time we heard anything about Bajor and the Lost City of Bahala. We at least get some throwaway lines later on in the series about, you know, the excavations at Bahala and what was being turned up. And I appreciate the fact that we revisited that. And because that's reality. If you find an archaeological site, it's not going to be a once and done and you never hear about it again. In real life, if you unearth an interesting archaeological site, it's going to pop up in the news now and then, and you're going to hear new things that are coming out of it. And we got to see that in Deep Space Nine. So, you know, kudos to the writing staff for revisiting that. I think this has everything that makes a really good Star Trek episode. And, you know, no phasers were fired during the episode. There wasn't an epic space battle. It was just this really interesting psychological / philosophical sort of journey that we took in this episode. And it was brilliantly written. It was brilliantly acted. Just what, like you, this is one of my favorite episodes of Deep Space Nine, and probably on my top 50 list of Star Trek episodes of all time.
It's actually a good thing I didn't become an archaeologist, because I am totally the kind of personality that could become really taken away and obsessed with trying to find an answer to a particular question, like spending my whole life trying to find the lost city of Bahala, or here on Earth, if I were going to become an ancient Egyptian archaeologist or an ancient Greek archaeologist or whatever it is, you know, some artifact, some city, some culture that I could just get my head totally wrapped in. I could spend my entire life pursuing something like that. So it's a good thing I decided to become a philosopher and not an archaeologist.
Well, again, Zachary, in my headcanon, I have to say that somewhere in this episode, although we never saw it on screen, Captain Picard found out about this excavation. He got a hold of Sisko. They patched everything up, and Picard promised that he was going to come visit Deep Space Nine and have Sisko take him on a little excavation of his own, the two of them down there in the ruins of Bahala. So I think we missed an opportunity, though, in all seriousness, for Captain Picard and his love, his interest in archaeology. I can't imagine this happening in the real universe without Picard getting involved somehow. I don't think he would have been able to resist the opportunity to get in on that excavation.
And you have to admit, Captain Picard has nothing on Captain Sisko as an archaeologist. And where the heck is Vash?
I know. Where's Vash?
There's got to be some valuable Bajoran artifacts that she is ready to gather and sell to Quark or
something. She ran off with Q again. So that's a really great way. Instead of, like, you remember Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego and Find Waldo and all of those things from like back in the 80s, 90s. I think that's like the Star Trek.
Where's Vash?
Where's Vash?
That's actually the Federation's like training program on archaeology. It's rather than Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, it's Where in the Galaxy is Vash. There's an old school reference for you guys. Well, we don't actually do a lot of rewrites on Metatrex, but I would totally rewrite this episode with Captain Picard and Vash playing a role.
I think we need to do that sometime. Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about the Deep Space Nine episode Rapture and all the incredible, ineffable things that we find within it. But this isn't the only thing that we've been discussing here on Trek FM. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
It's interesting how they're doing the casting, but I think it would be nice to actually have two ships involved, because one thing that I feel Star Trek has long suffered from, even with Deep Space Nine, which did try to break out of it a bit, is that small world syndrome.
Standard orbit.
And Jim Carrey, as they're fighting, he's like singing along, like, brah, brah. As he's fighting, he's singing along as he's fighting Matthew Broderick. And man, it's just so good. Like, to me, that's like, when I think of Star Trek and pop culture, like, that is the one, that's the first scene that I think of in the cable guy there.
The orb.
This is another thing that we're seeing all over the world, but this whole idea that just because something is hard, we should avoid it. But that is absolutely untrue. I mean, just look at your life, look at my life, I look at anybody's life, and the things where people have learned the most have been the hard things.
To the journey!
Wait, you're saying it's like matter and antimatter when they interact? They
it's like costume and non-costume.
So costumes and non-costumes annihilate each other.
Yes.
In Voyager.
Exactly. That is how the universe is going to ultimately be destroyed, due to the interaction of naked people and people wearing clothes.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please, leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps. And you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. It's a closed group, and if you hit the join button, one of our admins will let you right on in. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek.fm Show and select Metatreks. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at Trek.fm and on Facebook at facebook.com/trek.fm. Well, Zachary, when you're not burning the midnight oil in one of Quark's Hollow Suites, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek FM as one third of To the Journey, Trek FM's podcast dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not busy taking the electric ractochino acid test, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, always on Facebook. That's where I'm most active, certainly around the Babel Conference. Love to talk Star Trek and philosophy with our listeners there. I'm also on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. Be sure and follow me. And if you're following me on Twitter, be sure and let me know so I can follow you back. Also, I'm occasionally on Instagram, that's cmichael1701, and if you'd like to read my blog about my journey trying to publish my novel and a little bit about life, you can catch that at cmichael1701.wordpress.com. So, Zachary, we want to tell our listeners about Patreon. If you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, all available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month, so we'd really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. We'd also like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatreks team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, and always the most perceptive person we know, executive producers Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, our Patreon manager, Brandon Shea Mutala. Zachary, we'd also like to throw out a big shout out and a thank you to our associate producers here at Metatreks, Patrick Devlin. You can follow Patrick on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at MagicDrop5. Your co-host over on To the Journey, Kay Shaw, is also one of our associate producers here. Her Twitter handle is at ChocoWeeble. And Kit Lofstadt. Kit's Twitter handle is at MotherCat, that's Mother with a zero and Cat with a K. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatreks, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.
Sit back and enjoy the show. It's like a 60s LSD trip. Whoa, the colors, man. I never thought of this episode as Captain Sisko as being on LSD, but a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. I better save this for the podcast. He does get kind of weird in this episode. I think it's Avery Brooks being Avery Brooks, because he's a strange dude anyway.